enough to completely feed the entire city, thus putting the project in the financial situation of becoming a major agribusiness and funding the formal creating of vertical farms anywhere it wanted. A different aim than the spaceship concept, but one I could still get behind. We'd been perfecting our methods all throughout the center of the country, gaining recruits, resources, and abilities. The second reason was Maggie. She was out here in the city. With the Mock Turtle's resources, I'd found her. I wanted to thank her. It sounded ridiculous, but sometimes it took losing something important to you for you to shake yourself out of your old habits and seek out something new. Something different. Sometimes, something better.
Elizabeth Baer is having a heck of a year. Her short story, Tideline, has racked up all sorts of awards, including a Hugo Award, which is sort of the Oscar for science fiction literature. And she's also released a number of novels. She's the Energizer Bunny of science fiction. She just keeps writing and writing and writing. Fortunately, we all benefit from her output. Baer's story here is excellent in its own right. But one thing I'd like to point out is how it, with Tobias Bekel's Stochast City, is an excellent example of how the working relationship among the writers of Metatropolis came into play. One of the things we did as writers was to show each other our works in progress, so we could see how the others were solving the problems of fleshing out this world we had created, and to make sure that our own stories connected with the others. In the case of Baer and Bekel, their two stories, both set in Detroit, are an interesting complementary set, and you can hear how the two share story elements and themes, even as the stories stand on their own. It's proof to me that the idea of communal world-building and individual story writing can pay off in really excellent ways. But you're about to find that out for yourself. Here's Elizabeth Baer's The Red in the Sky is Our Blood, read by Candace McClure.
Handlebars stung Katie's palms as her front tire popped off the curb and slammed cracked asphalt. Flexed elbows absorbed the jolt, but she still felt the sting across her shoulders. She skittered sideways between an auto rickshaw and two pedestrians and entered the traffic flow. Detroit had never had much in the way of public transportation, and decayed infrastructure made the public streets practically impassable. Katie knew that. Knowing it didn't manage to lessen her irritation much when she had to stop on Randolph Street and dismount so she could lift her bike over a pothole that stretched the width of the road. Another day, she might have ridden over and popped the bike up the other side, but today she couldn't afford to risk a tire. She was already late and didn't have the spare cash for a new tube. Heads turned as Katie swung the leg over her machine again and rocked up onto the pedal, balancing on the scarred ball of her sneaker. She shook her dreads down over her shoulders, tossing back the one that always wanted to spring forward and sway like a pendulum in front of her right eye. Some yub in a business suit turned round to stare at the stretch of her cargo pants as she kicked off and leaned forward. She could have flipped him off, but it was more fun to pump towards him, pedaling furiously, and tip his hat into the filthy street. "Bitch!" he shouted after her as she vanished into the stream of rattling trucks and electric squirts. Then she did flip him off, without turning, the finger pointing down stiff and rigid beside her pumping haunches. Somebody else whooped laughter. A steel bracelet, bright with rubber-edged jingling tags, rattling on his wrist as he waved. But Katie's antagonist shouted something she lost in a roar of giant wheels and the blare of her headphones as she slid in behind a truck. She was pretty sure it wasn't his phone number. And if it was, she grinned as she pedaled down the echoing soot-blackened channel, anonymized by traffic. She had all the men in her life she needed. Those wrist tags bugged her as she slid along through traffic, finally making better time now. Every counterculture has its recognition signals, hanky codes and earrings, slave rings and crossed wrists, cryptic magnetic decals on the bumper of a car, peace signs, band badges, piercings, dyed hair, long hair, cropped hair, onks, safari vests, and leathermans, gang signs and team insignia, the colors of the tribe. Every counterculture has its ways of keeping the gate. Some are secret for purposes of exclusion and control. Some are secret by force of necessity. Some flamboyantly broadcast their existence, but adopt impenetrable habits of speech. Some are driven underground at first, for centuries or decades, only to emerge when the conventions of society change. But then they cease to be the counterculture. They lose their passcodes and secret handshakes. The recognition symbols that once served to discreetly identify them to friendly eyes become an open badge of membership. A Christian fish, a rainbow flag. Nuances of nonverbal communication are lost when it becomes safe to speak out loud. Lately, Katie had been noticing the tags. Rattling silvery metal, worn on a steel ball chain looped around throats under tailored sport coats, through the worn buttonholes of frayed denim jackets, hooked on a keychain carabiner. Sets of 3, or 5, or 7, once 9, always odd numbers. The thin sheets of metal rolled in colored rubber at the edges for safety, and perforated like lacy antique punch cards. She hadn't gotten a good look at a set, but she thought there was some transparent, refractive material sandwiched between the layers of metal, visible where the cutouts fell. They weren't customary. She'd catch somebody with a set every couple of days, a few times a week. Once, she'd seen 2 in a day. She wondered, sure. Googled around a little, checked a couple of trendy stores that sold fashion accessories. Found nothing. The thing that struck Katie odd was that the tags, which looked more than anything else like miniature fine jewelry replicas of dog tags, were the only thing the people wearing them seemed to have in common. She hadn't realized they were a recognition signal until she'd seen a bum in 2 pairs of 2 short trousers, 7 tags rattling against his filthy collarbones, nod in passing to a businesswoman walking between her bodyguards. A leather strap supporting a Pilot electronics tote crossed the shoulder of her designer suit. 5 tags swung freely from the strap loop. The businesswoman had smiled faintly and nodded back. By the concrete footing of a converted warehouse, Katie locked her bike and set the zapper. Somebody had stenciled an outline of a grinning man smoking an upside-down pipe on the wall. Whatever the encoded message was, Katie didn't get it. She hustled up steps to a rusted steel door that had once been painted orange. Somebody had told her there was no word for the color orange in Hindi. There was only yellow and red, and whatever lay between them had to be assigned to one category or another. It seemed strange to think about it first, but then she realized that all the colors between blue and green didn't have their own names either. Just names by association, teal and turquoise. An aquamarine. But weren't those colors just as real as blue or green? Didn't they have as much unique identity? Who was it that decided that they had to be one or the other? So if you spoke another language, and orange stopped being orange and became yellow, what then? Did the color itself change? Or was it just your perception of it? Katie nerved herself and tapped her code on the pad beside the door. Whoever was inside could see her on the cams. Facial recognition software had already identified her when the print reader on the keypad slid a bar of blue light along her fingertip. From its intensity, It seemed as if Katie should be able to sense a chill. Multiple system redundancy. The battered door sagged against its hinges as remote locks slid back. Katie squared her shoulders under her battered denim jacket, setting the fine swags of chain across the breast pockets swinging, and stepped inside. It was a long walk, past the guard's office with the door propped open by a chipped wooden wedge. The guard, a big, warm man burdened with the parentally reprehensible name of Celsius Washington, waved at her as she passed, his Marine Corps ring and his shaved head catching bands of light. She waved back. With meaty lips and chipped white teeth, he grinned. "Your little girl's grown up fine, just like her mom." Katie rolled her eyes and flipped him off like the guy on the street. But when she gave Sel the bird, it was a different gesture, with more English in it, and framed with a smile. More coded signals. Sometimes a fuck you was just a fuck you, and sometimes it was a whole bunch of other messages, and the fuck you was only the carrier wave. Consider how Sel pressed both hands over his heart and leaned back in his chair, head tipped winningly to one side. Fatigued metal groaned under his shift of weight. She walked on past, leaving the finger behind, framed in the door until her arm dragged it after, and heard him laughing all the way down the hall to reception. Here, the character of the building changed, from reclaimed property and scarred tile to soft carpet in bright tertiary colors complementary to walls and furniture. The receptionist, James, had hung up his suit jacket and rolled up the sleeves of his immaculately pressed shirt, but his tie still snugged crisply below his Adam's apple, and a semi-automatic pistol was clipped into a magnetic rig on his right hip. The reflected light from security monitors under the console wall gilded him blue. "Hello, Ms. Grange," he said. He touched the control for his headset and announced her, indicating a chair by the next set of security doors. James held up a plastic envelope while she retrieved a butterfly knife with a pierced steel handle and a can of tear gas from her inside pocket. She dropped her weapons in, and he bent the flap over, tucked it inside, and placed the resulting package in his top desk drawer, which he locked. "I always expect you to swallow the key when you do that," Katie said. James tucked a coil of light brown hair behind his ear, a transparently flirtatious gesture. He had great big hazel eyes with heavy eyelashes, and was at least 10 years too young for her. "And so what?"
"You're not staying long enough for that to be effective security."
She laughed and took the indicated chair, listening to the whisper of her metal fringe as she leaned her head back against the wall and closed her eyes. "Too much work, not enough sleep. But there was no easy solution for that in her life, either." After a suitable pause, James cleared his throat to draw her attention. She straightened, blinked, and was already rising when he said,
"The staff will see you now, Ms. Grange."
The inner door swung open as she turned toward it. She passed within, was wanded, and walked through the imaging portal. The security staff were used to her jacket now, but they still gave it a thorough hand examination. It was heavy in part because there were layers of body armor behind the swinging chains. Nothing extravagant. Nothing she'd want to rely on to protect her from a gunshot. But a little extra edge, the sort sensible people acquired. Katie smiled when they gave her back her jacket. "How bad's the coffee today, Angelina?" The woman with the wand, a broad-shouldered veteran whose straight black hair fell in a clipped line across her forehead, shrugged. "It's been on for a couple of hours. I'd see if it melts the spoon before I trusted it." She winked and waved Katie past. Katie fluffed her dreadlocks back and decided she needed the coffee, for something to do with her hands, if nothing else. And even burned, it was real coffee, a luxury not to be spurned. She filled a ceramic mug, added milk, organic, local farm, no BGH, from genetically random free-range cows, and decided it wasn't burned enough to really need the sugar. It was a stalling tactic, she knew, every time. She anticipated the visit all day, rushed to get here, and then it was all she could force herself to do, not to scramble back out the door without going in to spend her carefully allotted, scientifically calculated time with Firouza. She turned and made herself face the one-way glass. Firouza, age 5 1/2, bent over a child-height table, her fingers and smock smeared with bright primary colors. A dab of yellow stood out against Firouza's cheek. Katie took a long drink of complex, slightly acrid coffee to brace herself, touched the biometric pad by the connecting door, and went in to her daughter. Firouza looked up as Katie paused just inside, a sunny grin warming her expression, "Mom!" The word was like a needle through her breastbone. "Hey, kiddo," Katie said. She dropped her jacket on the chair beside the door, crossed the room to Firouza, and buried her nose in the little girl's hair. She breathed deep, the clean tang of ivory soap and the thick scent of gouache. "What you painting?" Firouza wiggled blue-smeared fingers. "Clouds," she said. Katie dropped down beside her, bony knees pressing hard on the linoleum floor, and angled the paper a little so she could see better. Clouds, behind a tree, and the yellow sun. The tree was intact, regular, growing smoothly into the contours of a green finger-smudged hill. There was another one a little further away, a blurry brown animal which might have been a bear or a dog or a pony. "Who's this?" Katie asked. Firouza gave her the sort of look one normally reserved for mental midgets and random incompetents. "It's my dog, Archie." Katie, wise to the ways of children, did not inform Firouza that she did not have a dog. There was a crush dog, but his name was Rudolph, and he was a golden retriever, not a giant brown blur of hair such as this appeared to be. "Your dog?" Firouza nodded, solemnly. "The one we're going to get when I can come live with you again," she said, and smeared blue paint all over Katie's most rogue dreadlock. Katie stopped at James's desk on the way out to collect her effects and pay the bill. By the time she made it back down the corridor, the sky was periwinkle. She leaned against the crush's misleading facade and took a moment to reconstruct her own. The pause was more than a breather. It was her opportunity to observe her surroundings before descending to her bike. No one in sight. She unlocked her wheels and slung her leg over without incident. But as she was rolling down the sour-smelling alley to a cross street where evening traffic drifted past, a silhouette detached itself from the left wall and stepped gingerly towards her, both hands upraised beside its head. Katie hesitated, hip shot, one leg stiff on the pedal as she coasted forward. Stay or go? She had the speed to jolt past him, knock him aside, and go spinning out of the alley. Detroit had some little up and down, but nothing like when she'd lived in San Diego. He'd never catch her on foot. Something jingled on the figure's wrist, casting rainbow sparks of light against the grubby walls. "Cadence Grange," he said. And though his voice wasn't quite the same as when he'd been shouting after her, she recognized it. Katie stood on the foot brake, the bike wobbling slightly as she balanced it to a halt. "Who wants to know?" Once they were ensconced in a booth in a greasy spoon, prompted Katie to ask, "Who names their kid Homer anymore?" "My parents were Simpsons fans." He took a bite of what passed for hamburger these days and wiped mayonnaise off his chin while Katie studied him. He looked about mid-twenties, lightly freckled across the tops of his cheeks, his hair sticking out this way and that in tiny random twists about 2 inches long. His T-shirt bore a sweat stain around the collar. His forearms were tendon-cabled below the rolled-up cuffs of his cargo jacket, and a Marine Corps ring, like a smaller cousin of the one Sal wore, glinted heavily on his hand. Before he sat down, she'd noticed his boots were scarred across the toes, deep enough to show the steel caps in one or two places, and the laces were knotted together where they'd worn thin. Now she spotted the calluses on his hands, the chipped fingernails. She asked, "What do you do?"
Not, "How do you know my name?" or "What do you want from me?"
Another bite of hamburger. He was buying time. He pushed the paper basket of fries toward her while he chewed. Hands folded around the water-dewed cup of iced tea he'd bought her. She frowned at the fries. Her stomach grumbled. But there was brown rice and beans at home. And if she was lucky, the market she passed on the way would have the cheap, bruised oranges from Florida she could almost afford. Beans and brown rice and oranges. Not the best diet, but it wasn't missing anything you couldn't live without for a while. Sometimes, she scored greens as well, or lemon, or lime. She got by. Better than some people did.
"No, thank you," she said. "I don't know where that's been."
He laughed, covering his mouth with a napkin.
"I'm a blogger," he said.
"Huh." It seemed like he expected more, so she pressed her palms against the table and said, "You make a living at that?" He set the burger down. The smell wouldn't have been all that appetizing, even if she hadn't been able to see the gray interior. But it still made her swallow saliva. And wiped his hands before fiddling significantly with the frayed cuff of his cargo jacket.
"I get by. Since we're playing first date, what do you do?"
The coincidence of phrasing made Katie raise her eyebrows.
"Screw it," she thought.
"Don't you already know?" That could have been a wink, a flinch, or a nervous tick. Whatever it was, he eyed her steadily afterward, his impression sliding incrementally into a frown. He wanted her to break, she thought, to look down or glance aside. Instead, she tilted her chin up slightly and stared down her nose, matching him frown for frown. Finally, he snorted laughter, rolled his eyes, and shook his head.
"All right."
He reached inside the jacket and palmed something from an inside pocket. Katie's hand had already closed around her butterfly knife when he rotated his wrist and revealed a personal omni-communications device. State-of-the-art. Metallic purple matte finish with a strokeable texture. He drew his thumb across it and it popped open, revealing a screen. Her own image slid into focus, digitally sharp. A flash of her downturned finger beside her butt cheek, and below that, the registration plate on her bike.
"See?" he said. "No mystery about it."
She relaxed, incrementally, but didn't take her hand off the knife. "And this is how you get a date?"
"No," he said. "This is how I make an offer. See, I know your name isn't Cadence Grange."
She thought she kept the reaction off her face. She'd practiced in the mirror, but the pierced handle of her knife left raised bumps in her palm as her fist clenched. That was fine. Homer couldn't see her hand in her pocket, and the edge of the table would hide it if her forearm had bulged.
"Really? That's news to me."
His grin broadened a little at her denial.
"Now how did I know you were going to pull that bluff?"
He shook his head without taking his gaze off her, a cat intent at a crevice. Katie wondered if he could hear the knocking of her heart, if he somehow knew about the cold sweat on her palms and the way her stomach twisted in nausea.
"All right, fine." He lowered his voice. Cadence Grange wasn't always your name.
He reached for a fry while Katie, despite herself, froze like a scared rabbit. He dipped the fry in ketchup, ate it, and made a face that made her wonder if he was mugging for his audience of one, like a bad movie villain, or if he honestly thought he was funny. What kind of narcissism did it take to try to entertain someone while you were leading her to the gallows? He washed the mouthful down, rattling ice as he slurped, and said, "I know that people are looking for you and her, and it would be very bad for you both if they found you. Your real first name is Scarlet, like the color. You are technically still married to a foreign national, and not only is Firouza Grange also an assumed name, I assume because of her kidnapping risk, but she's also not your daughter."
"Stop," she said it softly, but her voice brought him up short. "She is my daughter, asshole."
The voice in her head that said it was answered by others, though, as always. The one that said, "Stepdaughter," and the one that answered, "And if she is, why can't you stand to look at her?" They sat in silence for a moment, staring at each other across the worn Formica tabletop, through air that stank of rapidly cooling grease and overcooked hamburger.
"What do you want?" Katie asked, when she could gather herself to say anything.
Homer shook the ice against the sides of the paper cup. The gesture made the tags on his steel bracelet rattle.
"I want to help."
Homer's ride was racked up outside the burger joint, where he must have left it when he came around the corner to fetch her. Katie had inadvertently locked her own bike a few slots down, and she rehearsed her options while she released it. She could make a break for it. No telling how good Homer was on his wheels, but almost nobody could keep up with Katie through downtown if she really didn't want to be kept. But if she tried to ditch him, he had her registration, which meant he knew her address of record, and he would have no problem finding out who she ran packages for. And he knew where Firouza was. Katie had plans for vanishing, like any good fugitive. But before she could use them, she'd have to shake Homer and get a message to the creche, which had its own more than adequate security and evacuation policies, the reason Katie had chosen it over any number of legitimate residential co-rearing facilities. That, and Taurus wouldn't get cooperation from the Detroit families if he came looking. There weren't any favors there for him to collect, and enough bad blood, Katie hoped, to make a smokescreen thick enough to conceal her and Firouza. Homer might be decoying her someplace private to do her harm, but he hadn't made an aggressive move when they were alone in the alley outside the creche, and she certainly hadn't grown less wary of him since. And if he was working for Taurus, then Taurus already knew where she was, and by the time she got back to the creche, Firouza would be gone. The possibility made her miskey the release. She dried her palms on her trousers before she tried a second time. Taurus, though, it would be like him to bring her back so he could make her regret the error of her ways, specifically and in detail. But games of cat and mouse, wasting time distracting her, that would be out of character. He'd take her out and get what he had come for without unfortunate sentiment. He was efficient, focused. She'd found it attractive as hell once, before she'd learned what he was efficient and focused about. Before she'd had it demonstrated by way of Erzabet, Firouza's biological mother, that efficient and focused were only manifestations of ruthlessness. When she'd confronted him on his affair, she hadn't expected his response to be her rival's corpse. He would have killed Firouza too, if she'd asked. She was sure of it. Instead, she'd asked for the little girl as a gift, and Taurus, magnanimous as long as you kept him pleased, had had his daughter delivered in a basket. That was the day upon which Katie began making her plans for escape. No. If Homer were working for Taurus, Katie would already be as dead as Erzsébet. Katie wondered if there were a woman for whom her own murder would now serve as a gift. She wondered whether Taras's father had wooed his mother with similar offerings. She couldn't trust Homer. She couldn't trust anyone. Taras had taught her that. But she could grit her teeth and pretend to trust Homer at least as far as she could throw him, at least as long as it took to learn what his game was. Pretending to trust didn't mean being stupid, though. She triggered an emergency code on her Omni as she slung one leg over her frame in unison with Homer's mount-up. And she felt the better for doing it. If it wasn't already too late, somebody would be getting Firouzah out of harm's way even now. If the staff of the crush hadn't been bought out, if... There were a lot of ifs to worry about. When Homer pushed off, Katie followed. They glided into moderate traffic like two fish entering the school. Homer's ride was as scarred as his shoes, gray-painted and dull-looking. But Katie knew a little about bikes, and the frame under that sloppy coat of primer was titanium alloy. She thought she could name the brand from the silhouette, if there were a sudden quiz. Walking with a bike would have been awkward, but so was trying to talk while pedaling through city traffic. Conversation would have to wait for their destination. She still did pull up next to him in a lull in traffic and called, "Where are we going?" "The secret clubhouse," he called back. Maybe that grin was intended to be encouraging, to make this all feel like an adventure. Maybe if she hadn't been shaking with adrenaline and doubt, she could have grinned back. As it was, if she'd been carrying a stick, she would have spoke the motherfucker. He only made her chase him for about 10 kilometers by the odometer on her handlebars. Traffic, growing lighter in the dark, had all but dried up by the time they pulled into the driveway of an unassuming, treeless ranch house with the interstate running through its backyard. A bike rack stood by the door, screened from the road by a piece of weathered stockade that looked like it had been assembled from salvaged fencing materials. 4 bikes, none of them quite as battered or nondescript as Homer's ride, were already racked. Homer dropped his into the 5th slot and engaged the lock. Katie followed suit, but rather than locking in, she just touched the key and let her hand slide off again. Sometimes the option of a quick getaway was worth a little risk. She took 2 deep breaths to slow her heart and put herself at Homer's shoulder as he centered before the door. The tags on his left wrist rattled when he reached for the handle. A biometric scanner concealed in the knob glowed blue through his palm for a moment before the lock clicked. Homer swung the door open and stood aside. "Ladies first." "Oh," Katie said, "I don't think so." How many women are injured or die because they're not willing to seem impolite? She waited while Homer considered, nodded, and stepped in front of her. Sending him in first wasn't a lot of protection, but at least it meant he wouldn't be between her and the door if there were an ambush. She thought about trying to jam the lock as she passed through, but the attempt would be obvious, and the chances of it working were small. She settled for leaving the door ajar, and was momentarily surprised that he didn't reach behind her to latch it. The only person waiting inside the cozily lit living room was a woman of average height, her gray hair pulled back in a bun and secured with chopsticks, a hairstyle Katie wasn't sure she'd seen in over a decade. Not in America, anyway. Katie knew her bias against men was unreasonable. She knew she shouldn't have felt a tickle of relief, but logic didn't enter into it. Women were comforting. They meant safety and allies. "Please," the woman said, "take a seat." Katie stayed beside the door, making no effort to conceal her assessment of the living room and its contents. A little box of a space, furnished in thrift shop chic. The green velvet sofa was at least 100 years old and probably had not been reupholstered in half that. The wallpaper was peeling, and as Katie's eyes adjusted, she realized that the lamps on the end tables generated their shimmering light from kerosene, not electricity,
No, thank you. She wanted to fold her arms, but it was smarter to keep her hands free in case she needed them. Who are you? The woman smiled, but did not rise. Stephanie Shearer. Yes, before you ask. It's my real name. Whatever that means. It sounded like the sort of name an unimaginative writing team would assign to a superhero's girlfriend. Katie said, That's a precise but useless answer. What do you want from me? She felt Homer shift his balance slightly away. So he respected Shearer, and was possibly a little afraid of her response to Katie's defiance. Either that, or he disapproved of the defiance itself, in isolation from Shearer's potential response. Shearer pursed her lips. You're Scarlett Boyko. I'd prefer, Katie said, icily, not to hear that name. Shearer said, So how did a nice California girl wind up married to the Russian mob? It's a long story. Katie could picture the conversation like intersecting fingers, locked at the base, but pointing in incompatible directions, pushing against one another. They could fence forever and get nowhere. Look, Stephanie, you already have me at a disadvantage. You know who I am, what I'm worried about. You have to have a pretty good idea of what I can do for you, or you wouldn't have had Homer here contact me. You can't imagine that I'm going to hand you any additional advantages until you give me a corner to stand on here. What do you want from me? Shearer's hands rippled on the arms of her worn cane chair. Trust. Katie shook her head as if to clear her ears, but her understanding of the word still hanging almost visibly in the air between them didn't change. She had to restrain herself from glancing sideways at Homer, as if to share an eye roll with him. Not that he was a likely source of solidarity, but any port in a storm. You're nuts. Not at all. Now Shearer stood, revealing herself to be of average height and build, and, by her movement, younger than she looked. Or perhaps she merely kept herself in excellent shape. She did limp heavily on one side, however, and Katie wondered if it were a transitory or a permanent hurt. Let me tell you about brand name loyalty. This time Katie glanced at Homer before she could stop herself. He was regarding her with amusement, and she didn't think it was directed at Shearer. You are deliberately wasting my time, Stephanie. The irritation was a pose. The more of her time they wasted, the longer Katie could stall, the more time the creche had to spirit Firouzah to safety. The first-class evacuation protocol was one of the reasons Katie paid such a premium for Firouzah's registration there. Brand names, Shearer said as if she had not heard Katie's challenge, represent a particularly successful exploit of basic human psychology. They work because of the metrics humans use to assign trust. Trust. You distrust me now because you don't know me. But in general, when you do begin to trust a person, it is because you know them, or you know people who know them, and can vouch for them. And you trust the word of certain people more than others, because you know them to be ethical, or well-informed. It's a reputation economy. Katie caught herself leaning forward a little. I'm listening. So a brand name is in essence a fake person you can feel like you know. The psychology is pretty simple. Homer cleared his throat and added,
And totally cynical in application, because there is no person back there. No reputation to rely on, no sense of ethics. A corporate board, which has the same sense of morals as a stiff dick.
Katie leaned against the doorframe, careful not to nudge the door itself shut. This time, she let herself fold her arms, needing the sense of support. I'm really not following why you're telling me this. At length. But she kept that part to herself. She didn't need to antagonize these people. We want you to understand why we've approached you and why it is that you should help us. We've approached you because of reputation. Your personal reputation.
because you were willing to go up against Taras Boyko to protect the life of a child to whom you have no biological connection, and against whom you have reason to harbor a good deal of resentment. She's a child. Nonetheless, Shearer said, nonetheless, you want something from me. She shrugged, a fatalistic gesture that Katie took as confirmation of her, Katie's, grasp of the obvious. Nearer by, however, Katie saw the corner of Homer's mouth twitch. We want you to do something for us. Something dangerous. Or else you'll hand me, or Firouza, back to Taras?
Miss Grange, Homer said, sounding tired. We are the good guys.
Good guys. Sorry. Right. But Katie didn't say that either. Then stop yanking my chain, please. Or my leg. Or whatever it is you're pulling until it's about to come off with a pop. What do you want, and why should I help you? Shearer wasn't done with Katie that easily, though. She smiled and glanced at Homer, who shook his head. I always forget what it's like, dealing with people who've been living outside for too long. Cadence, who do you think your crush turns to in order to evacuate threatened children? Who do you think is most interested in raising children away from government programming? We know you can barely afford the residential program Firouza is registered for. She couldn't stop the nervous scrape of tongue and teeth across her lips, and cursed herself for how much it gave away. What do you want with my daughter? She's not your daughter. Stepdaughter.
Interesting philosophical question, Homer said. Is your spouse's bastard child still technically your stepchild, or is it some other kind of non-biological relationship?
The sharp chill along Katie's spine intensified. She was good at keeping her expression impassive, a skill she'd perfected while living in Taras's house. But apparently her poker face wasn't good enough this time, because Homer and Shearer shared a significant glance, and Shearer said, We're not going to hold her hostage. We'll help you take care of her whether you assist us or not. Rather than easing the tension across her shoulders and neck, the nonchalance of her statement brought it into sharp focus. You're giving me my child back. Just like that. What if I tell you I don't want your help?
We'll try to convince you otherwise, Homer shrugged. We don't operate that way.
But why not? Shearer smiled. We're the good guys. She limped a few steps away, as if giving Katie room to think clearly. But once she got there, she turned back and twisted her hands together earnestly. And we want you to be one of the good guys, too. Human neural hardwiring is deeply tribal, at the bottom of it. One builds trust by mutual cooperation. It's like branding, only there are real people standing behind it. She jingled her tags, a shimmer of sound like a glass wind chime. To want to help us, you have to trust us. To build that trust, we offer you help first. I realize we have some work to do with you. Katie grimaced. I mistakenly married a Ukrainian mobster, she said. He killed his mistress while we were married and claimed he'd done it as a gift to me. It's not the sort of mistake you want to make twice in a lifetime.
No, Shearer said. I imagine not.
Homer shifted his feet.
You know, when Bluebeard tells you not to look in that little room under the stairs.
It shocked Katie into laughing. When she finished, she reached for the chair beside the door, the one she had been standing next to. She turned it slightly so it faced Shearer. The scrape of its legs on the gritty floor set her teeth on edge, and dropped into it decisively.
It's time to ask for a divorce, yes.
Are you going to tell me what you want from me? They looked at each other again. Homer shrugged.
You have a route out of Eastern Europe, Shearer said. One Taras Boyko obviously does not know about or know how to monitor. And if he doesn't, it's a safe bet that nobody in government does either. We need it.
There are people there who want to join us. You're our hope of getting them out.
Oh, Katie said, when the silence had gone on long enough to make her shift from buttock to buttock with discomfort. I see what you mean about dangerous now.
Scarlet. In Russian, the word for red was the same as the word for beautiful, as Taurus had more than once reminded her. Another reason Katie had been only too eager to leave her name behind. Not just because it was also his name, but because he had managed to ruin the part that wasn't.
Shearer paused to pull a cane out of the stand beside the door, and then gestured Katie and Homer after her as she led them down the short hall toward the back of the ratty little house. As she followed past the rear rooms of the house, Katie made herself breathe evenly and calmly, and keep her hand from nodding around the butterfly knife in her pocket. She didn't need any more dents in her hand. Katie asked,
"So, do you live here? In this house? It's a sort of safe house?"
She thought of terrorist cells, pallets on tile floors, six to a room. Homer shrugged.
"Who lives anywhere anymore? We're digital nomads."
When he patted the Omni on his belt, his tags jingled.
"Where my data is, that's my home. Stuff is just stuff. Almost anything can be replaced. Or rented."
A lesson Katie had learned hard and well. When it's time to run, you run. And don't worry about your suitcase.
"Still," she said, "you've given me a lot of ammunition. Makes me wonder how you're lying to me."
She wasn't sure why she gave them that. Frustration. The urge to provoke. The hope that if she made Shearer and Homer angry, one of them would let something slip past the facade. Whatever response she anticipated, it wasn't that Shearer would snicker behind her hand.
"Honestly," Shearer said as if speaking to a ridiculous 10-year-old, "what do you expect anyone could do to us? Confiscate our goods? We don't own any. Send us to jail? We're not doing anything illegal, short of a little trespassing, although I suppose they could legislate against us. But if that happens, we just move on. We're pioneers, Miss Grange. We're leaving your stratified society behind and building something new."
Shearer shifted her weight entirely to her crutch on the left side, and with her other hand threw open the door at the end of the hall. Wet, warm air and green light enveloped Katie, as if that door led into a jungle. She half expected birdsong. Shearer ushered her forward. Framed in the door, Katie stopped short, one foot still raised. Slowly, she put it down. The walls of what must have once been the master bedroom had been torn off, the spaces between the framing replaced with heavy billows of translucent plastic and glass walls constructed of a mosaic of car windows fixed together with lathing and caulk. Just within those stood tall racks, reaching from floor to ceiling, that looked as if they had been assembled from old car bumpers. The racks were full of tanks, and the tanks were full of plants. Tomatoes, cucumbers, gourds, melons, things Katie didn't at first glance recognize. The air smelled green and sharp, fecund. She breathed deeply by reflex, and had to remind herself not to enjoy it.
"The garden?"
When she looked over, Homer was grinning.
"Distributed resources," he said. "There are a lot of abandoned homes in Detroit. Some of them are petroleum farms, some are food farms. All salvaged materials. We have our own network. All salvaged materials."
"Salvaged?" The planters were old-fashioned plastic gallon milk jugs. Katie reached out and touched the nearest, setting it swinging slightly. Moisture dewed her fingertip. She rubbed the pads together, thinking she would like to taste it.
"Landfills are essentially giant plastic mines," Homer said.
"All you need to live," said Shearer. "Food, water, a place to sleep, protection from the elements, connectivity,
exploitation of natural resources, manufacturing, stuff, is a dead technology, Miss Grange. The world needs to invent something new. New ways to live. We've proven that upsizing and globalization really don't work as well as we'd hoped. Economies of scale make stuff cheaper, but they also demand that we move stuff from place to place and create demand for stuff that's really not needed. And so rapid growth may lead to rapid collapse. With modern communications, you don't need to be big anymore to be diversified. And you think these are the first steps towards inventing it? More than the first steps, she said. The federal government has been manufacturing petroleum in landfills for years by seeding them with bacteria that consume organic material. But manufacturing synthetic oil doesn't help address issues of carbon load and climate change. And burning those hydrocarbons returns carbon load to the atmosphere that was previously trapped in discarded consumer goods. Growing carbon-negative crops and processing those into synthetic petroleum may be more helpful, but surely it's even more helpful to stop shipping your food from Costa Rica. Katie thought of the oranges at the market, trucked from Florida at perfectly daunting prices. She touched a broad-leafed plant by the greenhouse door. This is a banana. It is, Shearer confirmed. Katie said, You really are trusting of somebody you just met. We know you very well. Shearer folded both hands together on the handle of her prop. Besides, what are you going to do to us? Tell your ex-husband that we plan to smuggle a few random Ukrainians out of Kiev? I don't think so. Inform the authorities? You're no more a threat to us than a knife is to water, Miss Grange. It was just like Kiev. When order crumbled, something rose to fill the vacuum. Something like Taurus. Or maybe something else. Katie thought of people trapped where she had been trapped, without the resources she'd had. At least she'd had money. Taurus had never minded if she spent money. Giving her things was a way to keep her dependent, to ensure loyalty. She touched the shiny leaves of the banana again.
So you want to use me as a tool?
No,
Homer said.
We want you to be an ally. Come on. We've got something else to show you. We need to take a little drive.
I need my bike.
Your bike will still be here when you get back, if you decide you need it.
The other presumed bicyclists had never materialized, though their rigs were still by the back door. However, out of deference to Shearer's infirmity, when Katie and the others left the little house with a freeway in its yard, they took a tiny hybrid car with Homer driving, and Katie scrunched into the back seat, pondering. Perhaps it indicated a lack of imagination on her part, but she was having a hell of a time figuring out the catch. And like the feral animal she'd become, that in itself made her wary. If you couldn't see the trap, still stood to reason that there might be one. She had ceased to worry about simple abduction, or a hit, at least. If they wanted her, they'd had her the second she walked into that weird gutted house that grew like a leaf off the dying stem of I-75. There was no reason to string her along like this, except for a con. And a con would have been appealing to her greed or vanity by now. Of course, there was always the possibility that they were exactly as they seemed. Unlikelier things had happened. Katie folded her hands in her lap and resigned herself to wait. Wait, and ask questions, as Detroit purred past outside the hybrid's windows. The little car only made louder sounds when it struck rutted pavement. Katie wondered how it stood up to the mess of Detroit's alleged streets.
What makes you think Firouz is not perfectly safe where she is?
Homer didn't glance away from the windshield.
We found her.
A flat, informative answer, and a very good point. Katie settled against the back of the chair, folding her arms over the safety belt. Her butterfly knife gouged her hip. You haven't explained yet how you live without stuff, she said. Everybody needs stuff. Clothes, cooking utensils, sheets and blankets, vacuum cleaners, lawnmowers.
Shear rummaged in her purse.
How often do you mow your lawn?
Excuse me?
Your lawn. She craned her neck so she could look at Katie over her shoulder, frowning. How often do you mow it?
Right now I don't have a lawn.
Fine. And if you did?
Katie paused, thinking back to Taurus, his house, the staff and the manicured lawns. Just picturing the place, a dacha, by which he meant palace, had her swallowing nausea.
He's on the other side of the world, she lectured herself. He can't get to you here.
Except if she did what these weird people wanted her to do, she might be leading him right to her. Anyway, regular people probably didn't mow as often as Taurus's gardeners did. Once a week, she said, trying to sound like she wasn't guessing.
So what do you do with the lawnmower the other 167 hours of the week?
Oh, so you only need one lawnmower for 168 houses?
Well, no, Shearer said, because sometimes people want to mow their lawn at the same time. Everybody on Sunday afternoon, right? And sometimes it's dark out. But you can have one lawnmower for 10 houses, or 15. Or you can all chip in for a lawnmower and then take turns mowing all the lawns. Say you have one lawnmower in 10 yards. You mow 5 lawns Saturday, your neighbor mows 5 lawns Sunday, and then both of you are off the hook for a month. And collectively, you have saved the price and the resource drain of 9 lawnmowers. I mean, it would be more sensible not to mow the lawn at all, but people like short cropped grass.
You have to work within the sacrifices people are willing to make, and take it slow. Once they realize how much cheaper it is to share equipment, living space, and so on, a lot of them come around. We're really a quite communal species, the last couple of 100 years excepted. We've built bridges and mills and fences and barns as a team for centuries. When we've become conscious of the advertising messages that surround us constantly, exhorting us to own things, shinier and more expensive the better, we adapt remarkably well to sharing. Collective child rearing is already making a comeback. It's just too hard to bring up a baby alone. Here. She thrust her hand into the back seat. A metal circle like a medieval seneschal's keyring dangled from her fingers. A single pierced silvery tag swinging from it.
Take this.
What is it?
It entitles you to access our resources, as an apprentice, in a limited way. More tags are awarded for contributions. It's a means of keeping the unscrupulous from gaming the system. And of rewarding labor, which is one of the problems utopian communities have traditionally had. Well, that in attempting to move urban people into a rural lifestyle without the proper training or technology, so they more or less had nothing to do but starve and quarrel. But then, we're a practical community rather than a utopian one. Shearer paused, as if she was considering saying more. And then she shook her head and turned her face back to the road ahead, which now wound pockmarked and under-maintained through the sort of suburban war zones that had become unsupportable in the oil crunch. As they ventured deep into the wilds, Katie found herself watching carefully, as if spotting a potential threat along the side of the road would help them avoid it. There were gangs out here. Packs of the disenfranchised. Squatters and petty warlords. Nobody went out of the city if they could help it. Certainly, nobody took surface roads. Katie slid a little lower in her seat, half expecting a roadblock or group of armed men to materialize in front of them. She'd heard stories of cars stripped, of office buildings and grocery stores and homes sacked and occupied. Very small city-states, she thought, swallowing a nervous giggle. Shearer's voice interrupted her reverie. Go ahead and put it on.
Hmm?
The tag.
Dubiously, Katie fastened the ring around her wrist and shook it so the lone tag made a shimmering sound against the band.
Sounded pretty.
And are you taking me to your community? Homer took a hand off the wheel to gesture. Our community is everywhere. A core is easy to uproot,
A distributed model, like water to a knife, right? Katie meant to sound ironic and arch, but it didn't quite come out that way. These people were so obviously true believers. Fanatics. Cold. You guys aren't the ones who commandeered that skyscraper, are you? But Shearer snorted with such obvious dismissal that Katie instantly felt like an idiot for asking. And then felt like an idiot for feeling like an idiot. Because what was to stop Shearer from lying to her until she gave them what they wanted?
We salvage, Shearer said. We don't steal.
Homer caught Katie's eye in the mirror.
We come or go, more or less as we please. Some of us hold down outside jobs, like Stephanie.
He shrugged.
Some of us do